We're joined today by Ted Glick, who is the author of The 21st Century Revolution Through Higher Love, Racial Justice, and Democratic Cooperation. Ted has been a lifelong independent political activist, peace activist since 2003, a climate justice advocate. Reading some of his background, I saw he actually spent 11 months in jail during the Vietnam War for his resistance to the draft. And in the introduction to The 21st Century Revolution, Ted, you mentioned that you wrote a similar book 20 years ago. Why the desire to put out a new edition or a new version?
Of course, it's been 20 years. Things do change in 20 years. But the motivation for this book came from my reading the Bible, believe it or not, from beginning to end. I've been in and out of the church and in and out of a relationship to organized religion for my whole life. And my father, though, was a minister. And after he died, I took back home with me his Bible about a year and a half after he died. I happened to find it. And I noticed it had all kinds of underlinings and markings and so on. And I said, well, maybe finally I can read the Bible, because I've tried in the past and I've just never been able to get into reading the Bible. So, but I did. I spent about 6 months reading these 2,000 pages from beginning to end. And I came out of that thinking, here we are, thousands of years that people like the Hebrew prophets and Jesus, and then you had the Communist Manifesto and socialism and so on. All these thousands of years, we've been trying to change the world to something that is very different than the world we have. And, you know, we're facing climate catastrophe, ecological breakdown, societal breakdown. That's our reality. What's the problem? What's preventing us from making these changes? So that was really the motivation. I spent about the next year and a half reading about 30 or so books, beginning to write some other essays, and eventually it all came together into this book.
Now, one of the things you discuss in this book, human beings in various forms have been around for about 3 million years, and it was pretty much, a little bit more egalitarian and a little less, gender focus on roles until about 10,000 years ago, when we begin to develop what we called civilization and an agricultural society. And that dramatically changed the role of women to a much more subservient. What type of lessons do we need to be drawing, from that? And, how does, women's liberation, factor into your vision for a future movement?
Yeah, no, that's very critical. It's very essential that there is as you said, there is this reality of a patriarchal, male-dominated system, but also militaristic, very much about war and power and greed and class societies that all evolved, beginning roughly 10,000 years ago as hunter-gatherer societies, which were the main form of how human beings were living around the world. That began to change, not everywhere, but in certainly Europe, North Africa, Western Asia. Things began to change, and that led to a lot of very negative changes. There are positive changes, you could say, in terms of the development of technology, the development of economies, et cetera. There were, positive things that happened. You could certainly say that, but there were also a lot of negative things. The reality is that today, that we need to recover some of those much more egalitarian and a partnership view of how society should be run, not male dominated, not rich people dominated, not white people dominated, but a partnership approach, democratic cooperation based on racial justice and based on striving for higher love as the motivation of how that society functions.
One of the things I think most of us have noticed is it seems to be this tremendous fundamental shift among some of us might call young people, maybe 35 or younger at this point, where they just reject so much of the discrimination, whether it's based on race or gender identity, sexual orientation. that has been so prevalent in you know, previous generations. Do you think this is a really lasting change, or just, you know, a blip in human experience?
Well, I mean, I certainly hope it's a lasting change. I think it basically is. You know, there's no question. We certainly see this right now in the United States, that there's still, you know, a real strength of what I would call backwards thinking, backwards ideology, based on basically white, male, heterosexual, you know, rich people dominance, right, over everybody else. And but there's all there as you're right, and polls are showing it. Polls and just, you know, mass movements that exist, organizations that exist. There's an awful lot of people in the United States that see that we need to make the shift to a very different kind of society. And the key, or a key, to realizing the potential in terms of social change is finding ways to unite all these various movements. You know, people call it a movement of movements, and it's happening. You know, this is happening. One of the things that I was good for me, frankly, in writing the book is that as I worked on it, and I, you know, tried to think through how I saw what's going on, what's needed, I came to realize that there really is a lot going on that is very positive in terms of kind of a progressive social movement in this country and around the world. I do think it's here to stay. But the question is if we can make the change in enough time, because we're staring down climate catastrophe. We're staring down just tremendously negative things. We're already seeing them with the extreme weather events escalating. But I do have hope. It's a touch and go in terms of who's going to win this. But I think we have a chance of winning this one. I really do.
Now, you outline, you know, sort of three overarching tactics for movements. One, that it needs to be grounded in day-to-day community, including workplace and issue-based organizing. It must engage in independent electoral campaigns at all levels. And then it must continually but strategically organize public marches, demonstrations, and other direct actions on key issues. How do you hope that, you know, groups and organizers, you know, adopt that idea?
Well, all of those things are happening right now. I mean, every single one of those, they're all happening right now. The key is the extent to which we are able to, over time, unify these efforts. You know, unification doesn't mean some kind of mechanical, you know, artificial creation of something that calls itself something, but that the relationships among the people are not much different. The key ultimately are the relationships between individuals, between organizations, kind of a whole different way of how we see building a movement for change. That will have to take organizational form, some kind of a really broad-based alliance that unites, you know, all these different movements, or many of the organizations and the kind of the elements of our movements. But it is happening. All those things are happening. And that's, again, what I kind of realized writing the book. There's a lot that's going on. You know, I could begin to give examples, but there's probably not enough time. There's examples in my book.
The book is The 21st Century Revolution Through Higher Love, Racial Justice, and Democratic Cooperation by Ted Glick. How do people get a copy of the book if they want it?
The best, it actually is pretty available out there, you know, Amazon, Target, I believe, Walmart's has it, et cetera. It's out there that way. But I would urge people to go to pmpress.org, PM as in the opposite of AM, pmpress.org. Just put my name in the search box up on the top right, and you'll come to information about the book. Also about another book that got published of mine last year, Burglar for Peace.
Okay, we've been talking with Ted Glick, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. One of the things I saw in the book was learning from a gorilla. I guess the book name, or the gorilla, was Ishmael. But, you know, what struck you about that?
One of the things that was special about it is that Pete Seeger sent me the book. I met him I interacted with him somewhat over the phone here and there way back when I was the coordinator of the Independent Progressive Politics Network. In terms of my independent politics work, this was 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And, you know, he donated generously, actually, to that group. And he must have liked what we were doing. And he sent me that book, frankly, read it or tried to read it the first time and I was not very interested. But then I came back to it several years later and found it to be really, really valuable. It's a way of conceptualizing what's been happening with the human race, going back, you know, again, to 10,000, 15,000 years ago and all the changes that have happened. And it's a very kind of understandable, concrete, kind of down to earth, but also very wise way to see the way we have changed as a species. Essentially, the development of patriarchy first, the development of capitalism, the institutionalization of racism and white supremacy, building upon, of course, millennia of homophobia and heterosexism, all those things.
I mean, you talk about basically for most of human existence, 3 million years, we've been much more, say, in our concept of the sacred, much more of earth goddess,
right.
Of a connection to nature. You sort of describe it as a transition from leavers to takers. What did you mean by that?
Well, that's the terminology of the book Ishmael. That the leavers were the people who were living much more in harmony with nature, the hunters and the gatherers, the people living in smaller groups. The takers began to develop with agriculture and the emergence of agriculture on a much more significant scale, as well as the raising of animals, the raising of and eating of and the use of animals, taming wild animals for the benefit of human societies. And so the takers, just, you know, as the name implies, were into taking land build bigger fields of grain or whatever it was that was being grown, and taking people's land. And it just, you know, there was a change that happened in the way human societies functioned. That's the essence of what the book explains, and but also gives hope in terms of how people, it's not like something that has to stay like that. And there are many examples of people, of institutions, of organizations, of major institutions, even in some cases, being about something different and trying to change things. And that's what we have to do by uniting our forces so we can really change the world.
Well, let's talk a little bit about uniting forces. I would expect that, you know, many, activists on, you know, sort of the left side of the aisle would generally agree with, most of your major, suggestions about how we should organize. But the left has always been so fragmented and so turf oriented, you know, only occasionally, you know, when somebody like, say, Jesse Jackson comes along, who seems to be able to, you know, transcend some of the boundaries, have groups really been able to work together? How do we get to a point where people, you know, are sort of willing to, you know, maybe make sort of secondary, whatever the central issue of their group is, to the understanding, which I think most of us articulate, that we're never going to solve climate, we're never going to solve racism, we're never going to solve sexism and homophobia and poverty and inequality unless we really solve them all together, and that, you know, trying to create that different world is, you know, perhaps secondary to the immediacy of the particular, you know, issue or crisis we're working on. How do you get people to actually come together and put aside their differences and focus on their unity?
You know, again, I think some of that is happening. I mean, within the climate justice movement, for example, there was just this action that went on in Washington, D.C., where about 200 organizations joined together. And for like a whole week, Monday through Friday, there were actions that took place mainly at the White House, one day at Congress. 650 people were arrested, demanding that Biden take action to declare a climate emergency and stop. No new fossil fuel projects. That was led by indigenous people. It was a multiracial effort with very strong indigenous leadership, and there was a really good political process at work. And there are some other examples. That's just one example. So some of this is happening. But you know the bottom. I guess for me at root, the key to us being able to do what you're saying needs to be done, what I'm saying needs to be done, is a different conception of leadership. You know, we've had this conception of leadership that it's the great individual, and that's true within the left too. You know, it's the great, you know, Lenin, it's the great Marx, it's the great whomever. There is a whole different conception of leadership that's been around for a long, long time that is increasingly being put forward and consciously projected and developed, called group-centered leadership, where that leadership is best when it's all about developing the leadership from other people, about working in a collective way, not having, again, these great individual men, mainly is what it is, mainly white men, but it's not just white men. This is true in all cultures. So, frankly, in terms of this research I did over these years, I really came to believe that this is the key, that if we really begin to focus on how can we develop a group-centered way of building organization and of building movements that's all about empowerment of people coming into the movement, helping them develop their leadership capacities, finding the ways to work together collectively that's healthy. It's not that there aren't going to be differences. There always are going to be differences. It's how we deal with them, how we work together. So I think that's very key. That's something we really have to focus on and talk about and write more about.
So we only have about 90 seconds left. And I know, you know, that you've been very active in the climate justice movement over the last couple of decades. One issue that concerns me is that I think many of us understand that, you know, capitalism really has been one of the root causes of the climate crisis. And, you know, unless we move to a more humanitarian, you know, form, I call it eco-socialism, that we're really not going to solve the climate crisis. But yet most climate groups at this point aren't willing to make sort of that fundamental radical change, even though they internally might understand that. How do we move that?
I think it is moving that way. I think increasingly people who I work with in the climate justice movements are seeing the necessity of those connections. They need to happen. Look at what happened in Glasgow, Scotland, with the latest, you know, world climate conference, where you had the biggest delegation was the fossil fuel industry, literally like 550 delegates from fossil fuel companies. I mean, the U.S. only had like 140. That kind of blatant stuff is just increasingly people are seeing it and people are understanding. Greta Thunberg is a really good example of the new youth leadership that's emerging, that has a much more anti-systemic view, you know, the system change, not climate change.
We've been talking with Ted Glick, the author of The 21st Century Revolution Through Higher Love, Racial Justice, and Democratic Cooperation. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.